Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The media chooses to ignore one of the Middle East's most important events in 30 years, instead giving attention to a fabricated post office caper.
It is a conspiracy theory almost as crazy as the Russia collusion hoax.
What they tried to cover up? A peace deal with Israel and the United Arab Emirates.
I hosted a very special call with two friends, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates.
Joe Biden's nominating convention turns out to be a vacuous nightmare.
Couldn't believe what we were seeing. You got this lunatic who says, oh, Joe Biden is going to be a moderate. Literally 15 seconds later, there's crazy Bernie going, Joe is going to be the most liberal president ever.
And we'll see why California might be making an ever so slight political shift.
The road to taking back the House started here in California. We won a Democrat congressional seat and flipped it red in a special election this past May.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24-7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, please, at Town Hall Review. Elite media didn't budge when it came to giving attention to a celebrated peace deal in the Middle East. Instead, the media story of the week was the unfounded allegation that Postmaster General DeJoy was colluding with President Trump to slow down the processing of mail-in voting in November. I invited Senator Tom Cotton onto my show to clear the air. We start with the virtual convention for Democrats this week. This Democratic convention is a nightmare. It's the most boring thing I've ever seen. My theory is we ought to have 21-hour interviews with 20 different interlocutors for Donald Trump. Just put him on for 20 hours. You can pre-record him so he's not too tired. I think that would be a ratings bonanza. What are we planning that won't be as disastrous as this Democratic thing?
I will leave it in the very capable hands of Donald Trump, who, if we recall, was the star of a number one hit television show on NBC back in the day when they would still cover Donald Trump favorably when it was good for their bottom line.
Talk to me about the post office. And I understand that this may not be a burning issue in Arkansas. I don't think it's a burning issue anywhere. I think that it's a completely fabricated crisis in order to knock the UAE-Israel deal off the front page. But what is this about?
There's a vast conspiracy hue of Donald Trump driving around in the middle of the night stealing mailboxes all across the country. No, Hugh, you're exactly right. This is cooked up out of thin air. It is a conspiracy theory almost as crazy as the Russia collusion hoax. It's a preemptive justification for Joe Biden's loss to Donald Trump so they can try to contest the election to say that the post office somehow rigged the election for Donald Trump. Hugh, let me put this in perspective. We had record turnout in 2016. If every single one of those voters voted again in 2020, and every single vote took three pieces of mail, the ballot request, the ballot mail out, the ballot return, that would still be less mail than the post office delivers on a single day. It would be a tiny, tiny fraction of the mail the post office delivers between Labor Day and Election Day. So, of course, the post office is equipped to handle a slight increase in mail-in voting. Now, what they cannot handle are a bunch of Democratic states passing radical, stupid laws saying that voters can request a ballot up to, say, the Friday before the election. The states have to be responsible on their own end and provide reasonable timelines for the post office to deliver election mail, which they have done for decades and which I am confident the men and women of the United States Postal Service will do once again. They don't deserve these unwarranted attacks by the Democratic Party.
I see my post guy every day. I mean, I really love this. We just sit around and chat, and he's just a terrific worker. I just think it's astonishing that people fell for this. The media is, Greg Gutfeld says, it's never about what Donald Trump has done. It's about what they're afraid he's going to do. And they fell for it again. They're like Wile E. Coyote.
Well, I think they're going to be even more surprised on November 3rd, Hugh, when they once again lose to Donald Trump after being so confident, working himself up into such, you know, a crazed further that the American people are going to repudiate him. The only thing the American people are going to repudiate is the far left radical liberalism of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. It's going to make America weaker. It's going to make you and your family poorer, and it's going to cause chaos in our streets.
I can't say I blame you if you slept through this week's DNC convention. Trying to stage the event virtually created some major challenges that the DNC planners might not have anticipated. It turned out to be a disappointment, both in ratings and excitement. My colleague Joe Piscopo turned to Corey Lewandowski, a senior advisor to the Trump campaign. From AM 970, The Answer in New York City.
What were we watching? I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed for them. I'm embarrassed that they don't get it. It's like an alternate universe. Corey, what's going on? And to use Bruce Springsteen, to use my man Springsteen for the Rising while you're showing rioters burning down other people's businesses.
These guys are doing 60-second videos. They were doing one-minute videos. Michelle Obama is getting all the praise in the world today for her video. What nobody wants to mention is she pre-taped this thing before Kamala Harris was even picked, which is a week ago. Joe, I had the privilege to talk to the president last night for a little bit. I obviously had the chance to give my condolences for the passing of his brother. Yeah, but we were watching a little bit of the convention together over the phone, and just we just couldn't believe what we were seeing. You got this lunatic by the name of John Kasich who says, oh, Joe Biden is going to be a moderate, and he's going to go the right. And literally 15 seconds later, there's crazy Bernie going, we've taken over the party, and Joe is going to be the most liberal president ever. These guys can't even program themselves right. Don't forget, these guys have no understanding how to do a visual event. No one has ever accused Donald Trump of not understanding the video component, the audio and the visual component of television. This guy, Donald Trump, is a master at this. And I can tell you this. At our convention, which kicks off next Monday, it's going to be very different. The president has said this very publicly now. He's going to have multiple appearances. So this is not going to be him hiding in his basement. This is quintessential Trump. And what we're seeing is the exact opposite, which is everyone's speaking for Joe Biden, but they're speaking from a week ago. And Joe, I just have to touch on this because it was amazing. Joe Biden had such an exciting week last week. They finally told him who he was picking for vice president, and he was so shocked that he had the iPhone held upside down, right? Didn't know which end was up, was talking to the wrong end, and all I heard him kept saying on that call was, Jill, Jill, are you there? Jill, are you there? Calling for his wife. I think he thinks his wife is the vice president. This is like House of Cards, for God's sake.
There has been growing concern over the state of the GOP in California. In 2018, the nation's most populous state lost all but 7 Republican seats in their congressional delegation. That's down a full 7 seats from where the California GOP stood in 2016. But the GOP is working to make a comeback. Jessica Patterson is the new chair of the California GOP, and she's looking to beat the Democrats at their own game. She was a guest on my program this week. What is the breakdown now in terms of total party registration in California?
Yeah, in California, Republicans have declined in market share for the better part of a decade. Since February of 2009 to February of 2019, we actually moved to third party status. In the last year, we have made a specific focus on voter registration here. We've registered over 300,000 new Republicans to the party. And just last week, we got a new report from the Secretary of State, from the Secretary of State's office, and we are actually only 0.05%. So we have been clawing our way back. And let me tell you, the message that we're bringing to California Republicans about what the failures of California Democrats have been, why there's been a mass exodus of nearly 1 million people leaving our state, why our state is so unaffordable, why we have rolling blackouts when we are one of the most innovative states in the entire union. And we have been focused on bringing that message throughout the state and what California Republican solutions are. People are listening, and they're ready for change here in California.
Can we get any of the congressional seats back? I warned every Republican I could when that they eliminated the state and local income tax deduction and the and limited the property tax deduction, that the mortgage interest deduction. They were killing themselves in California. And sure enough, they lost a bunch of Orange County seats. Are you going to win any of those seats back in the House?
Absolutely. And in fact, I talk often. The road to taking back the House started here in California. We did something for the first time that hadn't been done in 22 years, Hugh. We won a Democrat congressional seat and flipped it red in a special election this past May. But we have a couple more opportunities for pickup this year. We're leading with fantastic candidates. And then at the party level, we have built a fantastic infrastructure so we can get out there and motivate voters. We knew Democrats were going to be fired up. They moved up their primary to make it exciting for Californian Democrats. We held our ground, and on top of that, have the five-point boost. We got all of our great candidates across the finish line. They'll be there in November, and we're working hard to make sure that we get them across the finish line. Californians are fed up. They're not staying at home. They're making sure that their voice is heard. You know, Gavin Newsom and this failed great progressive experiment in California, we've seen that it failed. 2020 California is not what the rest of the country wants to be. It's not what Californians want to be, and we're ready for change here.
You know, Jessica, I'm one of the expats, right? I left. I left because the taxes were terrible and the city services and services across the state were declining. And I anticipated, I believe correctly, that there would be no choice but to raise taxes again. I believe Governor Newsom has proposed that. They have super majorities in the legislature. How high are taxes going to go in California, and what's the breaking point?
Yeah, and really, California Democrats know no bounds. Their entire strategy is to distract from what's happening up in Sacramento, not take accountability, and when it comes to paying the bills here in California, it's taxing the rich and asking for DC for money. And so we had to come to the table and say, we have other ideas.
Before we run out of time, I got to ask you about harvesting. Kevin McCarthy told me the Democrats made harvesting legal, and it is legal. Ballot harvesting is legal in California, and they exploited it ruthlessly. Does the party have now an ability to match the Democrats when it comes to ballot harvesting?
Yes, and we put it into action over in our March primary. We've recruited over 37,000 volunteers. We've had thousands of trainings, particularly in the stay-at-home order. We saw in our March 3rd primary, we made a difference in places like Los Angeles and Orange County, where they had all-mail ballots in that March primary. We turned out every single voter. We've already picked up an assembly seat in Los Angeles and Ventura County because we had turned out the vote so much. We sent two Republicans to a currently held Democrat seat for November.
Coming up.
After 49 years, Israel and the United Arab Emirates will fully normalize their diplomatic relations. They will exchange embassies and ambassadors and begin cooperation across the board and on a broad range of areas, including tourism, education, healthcare, trade, and security.
Israel's new peace accord with the UAE. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The rogue regime in Iran is rightly blamed for what's wrong with today's Middle East. Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, and even the Saudis have been hit hard by Iranian proxies. The Arab Gulf states on the Persian Gulf are particularly vulnerable, as they are just across the water from Iran. That vulnerability was surely a contributing factor to the peace deal signed late last week. The United Arab Emirates, the UAE, has officially recognized and has opened up relations with Israel. It's an enormous achievement. My Salem colleague Chris DeGaulle turned to David Rubin, diplomacy expert and former mayor of Shiloh in Israel, from AM 990 The Answer in Philadelphia. We pick up with a clip from President Trump's announcement.
Just a few moments ago, I hosted a very special call with two friends, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, where they agreed to finalize a historical peace agreement. Everybody said this would be impossible. After 49 years, Israel and the United Arab Emirates will fully normalize their diplomatic relations. They will exchange embassies and ambassadors and begin cooperation across the board and on a broad range of areas, including tourism, education, healthcare, trade, and security.
Tell me a little about yesterday, what we're to make of it.
Yesterday's events were President Trump described it as huge, and in fact it was. It was a huge breakthrough. And of course, the commentators are already saying that Trump was just looking for a headline to overshadow the Kamala Harris story. But it's really not so. This really is a big deal. Other than Egypt and Jordan, no country in the Middle East has dared to establish full relations with Israel. And this particular one has strategic geopolitical significance on a very high level. And the reason is because the United Arab Emirates is, well, it's a, for those who don't know, it's a relatively conservative Arab country. It's located in the Persian Gulf, adjacent to Saudi Arabia, and directly across the water from Iran. It has been going on for a while, covertly, but now it's becoming official.
Iran is certainly helping a lot of Arab nations begin to see Israel as a strategic partner, just because they all share at least one thing in common, and that is their unease with Hamas and Iran, correct?
Yes, it's true. Iran is actually creating these alliances. We just had that incident in Lebanon, that massive explosion, and everyone was wondering, well, what was it? Was it it was in a fireworks factory, supposedly. Well, to us here in Israel, it's obvious that it was Hezbollah ammunition. Hezbollah has always stored their ammunition in civilian facilities, and their weapons and their explosives and their bomb-making facilities are all in civilian places. And because Hezbollah, which is controlled by Iran, the Hezbollah terrorists, they basically control Lebanon at this point. Iran's fingerprints, their unintentional fingerprints, are all over this agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates.
How significant is it, the moves made in terms of the established, recognizing the establishment of Jerusalem as the capital and the movement of the embassy? What did that signify to Israelis, for those of us that may not totally understand it?
You have to remember that there were 8 years of the Obama-Biden administration that were disastrous for the Israel-United States relationship. Those 8 years, there was so much tension. And I recall Vice President Biden's visit to Israel. And during that period of time, there was a previously scheduled meeting by the Jerusalem Planning Board, during which they approved the building of a new neighborhood, and Biden went through the roof. He was furious. He was furious at how Israel would dare do something like that. The Secretary of State, Clinton, called up Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, and gave him a stern lecture. How dare you allow a planning board to give approval for a building in Jerusalem when Vice President Biden is there?
Another story that should have received more attention was the indictment of former FBI attorney Kevin Kleinsmith. Kleinsmith has agreed to plead guilty to making false statements, changing information in a CIA email, and fabricating evidence. It's the first guilty plea resulting from the investigation by the U.S. Attorney John Durham into the FBI corruption in the Russia collusion matter. Former U.S. Attorney Andrew McCarthy has written extensively on this story from the beginning. We return once again to Chris DeGaulle.
It looks like the FBI lawyer who was involved in the middle of putting together the fourth surveillance warrant on Carter Page, long after it was well known that the Steele dossier was farcical, after they were told, long after they were told by the CIA that Carter Page had actually been a CIA source working against Russia, while they in their FISA applications were portraying him as a Russian source working against the United States, long after all that, this FBI lawyer is poised today to plead guilty to manipulating or falsifying a document and making false statements in connection with this investigation. And that is under circumstances where the false statements are in connection with this FISA application that should never have been even considered, let alone let out of the Justice Department to go to the FISA court.
This Kleinsmith, this attorney that's pleading guilty, how significant is this? And what exactly is he pleading guilty to today? Kind of help us, if you could, truncate what's going down here today.
We all thought it was going to happen Friday, and it didn't. But what he's pleading guilty to is basically making false statements to the FBI. And in a nutshell, what he did was he learned from the CIA when they were preparing to do the fourth warrant on Page, the FBI agent who was going to be the affiant, meaning he was going to swear out the warrant, was disturbed because Page was saying publicly that he had been a source for U.S. intelligence agencies. And Kleinsmith's job was to get with the CIA. And basically the CIA tells Kleinsmith, look, we told you back in October 2016 he was a source. I think knowing how embarrassing it would have been for the FBI at that point, remember, this is now the fourth warrant. So basically what he did was he changed a document that said he was a source so that it would say he was not a source. And he gave that information to the agent who was going to swear out the warrant.
How significant is this story to tell if you're the Trump campaign, if you were advising them?
I think it's very significant. There's a way that you tell a sprawling story, and that is, Chris, you find two or three things thematically that people can hang their hat on as they hear all these disparate facts. The theme of this should be out-and-out fraud. This was fraud from the beginning. They relied on things that were untrue, and the only explanations for that are either corruption or incompetence.
To hear the entire conversation of Chris DeGaulle and Andrew McCarthy, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
the prosperity of the first world is considered evil by the purists who really think human impact on nature is bad.
A fossil fuel apologist on the Green New Deal, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Green New Deal that was released in February of last year was commended to Congress as a blueprint of sorts to combat harm to our planet from fossil fuel energy. It was so radical that it did not prompt any immediate legislative action or changes in commerce. But if you heard campaign speeches by Democrat candidates in the past year, indeed this past week, you should have noticed that major tenets of the Green New Deal are still with us. Here's my colleague and friend Dennis Prager with Alex Epstein, energy consultant and author of The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels.
My producer tells me you have something, if not new, a different approach to approaching the issue of the Green New Deal or the whole subject of green power. Is that correct?
I think that's generally fair. I mean, what I would say is, I think what he's referring to is, you know, we've got an election coming up. Obviously, everybody knows that. And my specialty is energy. So I decided I want to help candidates and citizens have the best talking points possible on energy, because right now I think we've just got this flood of misinformation and distortion about energy, environment, and climate issues. And so I wanted to figure out a way to give people the words they need when they need them. So I just created a free website called energytalkingpoints.com, and it has talking points on things like unreliable energy, the Green New Deal, the Joe Biden energy plan, what American energy policy should be, the so-called climate crisis, et cetera, et cetera. So I just hope that people go to that website, energytalkingpoints.com, and particularly share it with any candidates. I think there's a really big opportunity for pro-freedom candidates to win in the energy, environment, and climate discussion, but I think they're generally ill-equipped. And today's California blackouts are a good example where this is an opportunity for us to explain the benefits of free market energy policies, of not outlawing fossil fuels, the harms of mandating what I call unreliable solar and wind. But people need the facts and they need succinct ways of explaining them. So that's what I've created.
If the Democrats win and enact the Green New Deal, what happens to America?
I think there are two answers to that, because the Green New Deal is saying that we should get more or less 100% of our energy from unreliable sources, namely solar and wind. And that's completely impossible, so it won't happen. So if the Green New Deal literally happened, like if we literally did that, America would rapidly become a third world country, because we couldn't have a functioning grid and we'd have no transportation. And solar and wind have no real solution to transportation, certainly not airplanes and semi-trucks and all sorts of heavy-duty equipment. So if you literally did the idea, yeah, we'd become a third-world country and tens of millions of people would die prematurely, and then America's certainly military power would be undercut and the whole world would be harmed. The rest of the world wouldn't follow our lead, by the way. They would sort of happily take over different kinds of manufacturing and industry that we do. I think the more likely thing is that it's going to be, you know, the Green New Deal is going to mandate increasing amounts of solar and wind, and that's going to do one of two things. I mean, at the very least, what it's going to do is make energy, particularly electricity, much, much more expensive, because basically when you add unreliable sources of energy to the grid, they don't replace the reliable sources of energy because they need basically 100% backup. They just add to the cost. And if we also shut down reliable capacity, which it also calls for, we're going to have more and more what we have in California. So California, we have both unnecessarily expensive electricity, plus we have unreliability. And that combination is going to happen 10 or 20 times over if we do anything resembling the Green New Deal.
The scenario you depict, I believe, is entirely accurate. I actually have a question. Do you believe that the threat, the actual threat, of America becoming a third world country disturbs people on the left?
Certainly not the part of the left that I'm focused on, which is the, you know, you call them environmental fundamentalists. I mean, the really anti-human portion, because if you think about the whole idea of being green in its purest form means minimizing human impact on nature, a third world lifestyle is far closer to that than a first world lifestyle. Really, what a first world lifestyle means is that we've dramatically impacted nature to benefit human life. Something like Venezuela, they're living a much more natural lifestyle. So I think that the prosperity of the first world is considered evil by the purists who really think human impact on nature is bad.
We are undoing millennia of an outlook on nature.
Yeah, and I think it's important that this is a religion. And so I would think of the, I think of it as the, not the environmental religion, but the anti-human impact religion. And it basically has two tenets. So tenet one is that it's immoral for human beings to impact the rest of nature. And then tenet two is that if we do impact the rest of nature, we're inevitably going to be punished.
Coming up, the devil and Karl Marx.
You got a guy like Karl Marx who said some of the most hideous things on race, in regard to blacks, in regard to women. His anti-Semitic statements are blood-curdling.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you were alive in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or even the 80s, communism rivaled Nazism in classrooms, curricula, books, and newspapers. As far as classrooms go, the study of communism diminished gradually after the fall of the Soviets beginning in 1989, and now is practically non-existent. This is the argument from Paul Kenger, author and political science professor at Grove City College. Young people over the past 30 years have not been schooled in the meaning of communism, let alone the carnage and misery it had visited upon civilization. In his new book, The Devil and Karl Marx, Dr. Kenger gives insight into Karl Marx, the man. He spoke with Dennis Prager.
There's a very interesting statement in the book of Deuteronomy. There's a law there that you have to remember the evil that this nation Amalek did to you, the Israelites. And my commentary on that verse is you have to remember great evils. The average student today knows nothing about the Gulag, nothing about the starvation of the Ukrainians, nothing about the Great Leap Forward in China, nothing about the killing fields of Cambodia. Am I right or wrong in your opinion about what a typical college student today could not identify? And I went through that list.
Oh yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I mean, look, I mean, here we are. We're in a cancel culture today, Dennis. Right, where any statement that anybody ever made in the past can get you canceled. And you know, they went after Reagan last year around this time for something he said to Richard Nixon in 1972. You know, they've gone after everyone from Washington and Jefferson to even Lincoln. I mean, they're tearing down statues of Frederick Douglass, of all people. And you got a guy like Karl Marx who said some of the most hideous things on race, in regard to blacks, in regard to women. His anti-Semitic statements are blood-curdling. If any conservative said even one of these things that Marx said, dozens upon dozens of students would be on campuses, you know, demanding entrance into professors' offices who have busts of Karl Marx. Right. I mean, this guy had really vile views.
I had a very rare major, Communist Affairs. And I remember when I left Columbia after 2 years of graduate school, I remember thinking, you know, it was a fascinating major, but it's not going to be important because communism, not then, but within 15, 16 years, died in Europe. And I thought, phew, it's a good thing I didn't enter the field. Little did I know how important that major would actually be.
We've been warning people in the 1990s, early 2000s, that if you don't start to teach this past, the evils of communism, what happened in the Cold War, this could come back to bite us. AOC was born, if this is correct, it's off the top of my head, I think October 1989. So she was 4 weeks old, nursing at her mother's breast when the Berlin Wall fell. And then, you know, grew up probably going to public schools and then went off to college, and she learned none of this. And now here she is today. She fancies herself a quote-unquote democratic socialist, not understanding that socialism is one of the transitionary steps to communism, at least according to Marxist-Leninist theory it is. But people like her, we have a whole generation that never learned any of this. So I kind of like you. I had some of those same thoughts. I thought, well, you know, should I really even be studying this? I mean, but here we are, 30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and you now have a majority of young Americans saying that they prefer socialism over capitalism, and many of them even saying positive things about communism, and even favoring the abolition of private property.
Teen Vogue just had a piece for kids to read that there should be no private property.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I wrote a piece for the American Spectator called Teen Vogue to Teen Girls, Marx Good, Reagan Bad. And it talked about a hit piece that they had just done on Reagan, and it reminded them of a positive piece they had done on Marx a few months before that, and they were literally calling for, quote, abolition of private property, unquote. Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, they write, quote, the entire theory of the communists may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property, unquote. Magazines like this are able to get away with this because we've now educated or miseducated a couple generations of young people who have no clue what communism or socialism even are.
There was a French socialist who said all property is theft. I forgot who it was, but that was one of the original ideas of communism. Property is theft. So what's this with, I studied Marx. I did not know about the devil part, so tell me.
Yeah, it's really shocking. I mean, the guy wrote poetry about the devil. And people don't know this about Marx, but Marx actually fancied himself a poet. And really, Dennis, if he hadn't become a philosopher, and he probably shouldn't have because he was a pretty bad philosopher, actually he was a pretty bad poet, too, at least in terms of what he was writing about. but he fancied himself a poet, and he wrote a bunch of poems about Satan. And it's hard to tell at times to what extent these are autobiographical, to what extent he's talking about the devil, kind of playing the devil himself. If he's supportive of the devil's vision, it's hard to say. And I say that in the book. I try to make these careful distinctions where and when I can. But for example, his 1837 poem, this is called The Pale Maiden. And I think this one, Dennis, is really profound because I think this is autobiographical for Marx. He wrote, "Thus heaven I forfeited. I know it full well. My soul, once true to God, is chosen for hell," unquote. And you know, Marx was raised in a Jewish family that had many rabbis in the background.
But, Orthodox rabbis, both his father's father and mother's father.
It's a good question. They seem to be on both sides. And as you know, depending on whether or not they were Reformed or whether or not...
They were Orthodox, I think. This is an area that I'm somewhat acquainted with. But, of course, his parents converted.
They did. They converted to Christianity.
Coming up, constructive voices in tense and destructive times.
There has to be a change from a narrative of freedom and equality to a narrative of non-freedom and non-equality.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Democrats use coronavirus to bludgeon President Trump. Is it fair?
The U.S. healthcare system has far exceeded these other healthcare systems in rescuing people who have become infected with the coronavirus.
Israel strikes a peace deal.
This is a massively important story.
The foundation of America is threatened.
As you go through history, you find that if you plot out the duration of each empire, the line averages out through at about 250 years each.
And the leaders of Portland refuse to stop the mayhem.
They have turned a blind eye to the very dangerous rioting and looting, etc., that has gone on.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The civil unrest, the violence, and the racial tension that continues to mark so many urban areas across the nation today has been a catalyst for new voices to enter the conversation. Voices that can help their communities sort through the misleading messages we are hearing so loudly. Corey Brooks is senior pastor at New Beginning Church of Chicago, founder and CEO of Project Hood Community Development Corporation. Seth Leibson took a look at his recent column in the American Conservative from AM 960, The Patriot in Phoenix.
There's a pretty good op-ed in the American Conservative by an African-American pastor in the Chicago area named Corey Brooks. And I want to commend it to people on this point. Black Americans deserve better than BLM and 1619. Here's what he writes. This is from an African-American pastor. "In many ways, Black Lives Matter has become essentially an extension of the 1619 Project. The project tells a fabricated story of America's founding. For example, it seeks to relocate our nation's founding from 1776 to 1619, when approximately 20 slaves were brought to Jamestown, Virginia. This event, from the perspective of the New York Times, was the essential event that not only launched, but also defined our new nation." That is a rewriting of history. Right there, that is a rewriting of history. We were not defined this way. In fact, until about a year ago, no one would have even imagined that 1619 was a year worthy of thinking was our founding. Everyone knew it was 1776. Why the change? There has to be a change from a narrative of freedom and equality, which you can be proud of, to a narrative of non-freedom and non-equality. Slavery, years earlier, before Thomas Jefferson was even born, before George Washington was even born, before James Madison was even born, so that you can artificially affix as our starting point slavery and not freedom. You can love a country dedicated to the principles or the proposition, as Lincoln called it, that all men are created equal. That's an easy country to love. It's an easy country to want to make great. But how do you have a narrative? How do you have a theme? How do you have a tenet about a country not being great? How do you have a justification for reparations and radical transformation, or for that matter, revolution, if freedom and equality are your starting point? You can't. You can only do it if unfreedom and slavery is your starting point. And as I say, that is a rewriting of history. And that's what the smarter people are beginning, I think, to pick up on. The truth is there are two themes that run through this country from 1776 to 1865. One theme is slavery, and one theme is the Declaration of Independence and the freedom and equality therein and the extension of that. Well, guess what? There was a war, and one side won. We won. Thank God.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for joining us.